The Pacecast from Pace Communications, hosted by Anita Pace and very special guests.
There is something that Ronan Keating, Frank Skinner and Jamie Cullum and me are connected by. We all won Radio Academy Gold Awards on the same night. I was of an age where my mum and dad, probably my mum, decided that from schooling purposes, I was better. She didn't think the secondary schools were up to the standard she wanted in Trinidad. So they all stayed in Trinidad and I went to Edinburgh. I cried for 3 days. I knew my auntie, my uncle and my cousins and everything like that. But you just couldn't believe that your mum had abandoned you. So it shapes you, really. Made me all right, selfish bugger. They want the chat. They want that magic moment where somebody rings in with an utterly daft call, you know. Bernsey, there's, you know, Rose in Pocklington. Hi, Rose, what's up? I've got a frog in my toilet.
Hello and a very warm welcome to our very first Pacecast of 2024. I'm Anita Pace and it's great to have you with us. I hope 2024 is a very successful and enjoyable and healthy year for us all. So today's guest is someone I'm sure you've all heard of. He's a very familiar name, face and voice around this region. I'm delighted to say that our guest for the January Pacecast and the first one of 2024 is David Burns, otherwise fondly known as Burnsy. Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank
you. That was all beautiful and happy and optimistic, and then you've got the arch miserablest on your sofa, you know.
No, we love you. We love listening to you.
Well, that's very kind. That's very kind of you, but I am an arch miserablest. I'm a grumpy old so-and-so, but anyway.
Is miserablest a word?
Well, it is now.
It is one. We've coined a new word for the new year.
Well, it's a start.
So, as always with our guests, we've asked Burnsy to bring in something that's special and meaningful to him.
Okay.
I don't know what it is, so I'm looking forward to hearing all about it and why you brought it in. So what is this object?
Right, okay. So it's not a rucksack, though I'm quite emotionally attached to the rucksack. Wonderful invention. There is something that I think Ronan Keating, Frank Skinner and Jamie Cullum and me are connected by. Okay.
This is a good quiz question.
All right.
Ronan Keating.
Frank Skinner, Jamie Cullum and me. On that particular night.
I'm not going to guess. Go on,
all right.
Share.
So there you go. That's a Radio Academy Gold Award. We all won Radio Academy Gold Awards on the same night.
And that was for?
What does it say on the top? Best Local Radio Show 2018, David Burns, BBC Radio Humberside.
Yeah, well
there's,
done.
There's not too many about. It's quite solid, good as a doorstop. And they won other presenting awards that night. Though I wasn't actually there.
You weren't there to
receive it. Yeah. I'd booked a holiday and my wife wouldn't let me come home early, get an earlier flight to be there for the awards.
And this was in London, obviously.
I think it was in Manchester.
Oh, it was in Manchester.
I can't remember.
Right.
I was in Portugal, as often was, often am. So, yeah. It's important to me because it was like, that was the pinnacle of my broadcasting career, really, to win a Radio Academy Award. Not many people do it, for the best local radio show in the country. And there are a lot of them.
Yeah, there are a lot.
To do it. And, you know, I was dead chuffed.
Yeah, rightly so,
really
rightly
pleased.
So.
Yeah.
A deserved accolade. But we will come obviously back to your successful broadcasting career.
Mm-hmm.
But let's go right back to the beginning. So I understand you were born in Glasgow.
I am.
And not many people probably know that.
No, I'm free Govan.
So let's talk about
myself and Sir Alex Ferguson from Govan.
Govan is where in Scotland? Isn't it
in
Glasgow.
Yeah. We're on the Clyde, basically. It's the home of Rangers Football Club. It's another connection with Sir Alex Ferguson. My grandpa worked on the Clyde in the shipyards in Glasgow. And the family from, well, I was born there in what's known as the Suffering General Hospital. But my mum and dad were from the Gorbals, which was like the biggest slum in Europe. But Glasgow's a wonderful city.
So how long were you in Glasgow?
I left when I was 5. The city fathers decided I was too hard for Glasgow and kicked me out.
That's not the real reason, we know.
No. My dad, who on his passport had the wonderful job description of rubber technician,
There's some jokes there, isn't there?
There is some jokes there. We'll not do them. This is a clean podcast on the Pacecast. So my dad got a job. He worked for Dunlop. He got a transfer from outside Glasgow to Nigeria. So we went to Nigeria.
So the whole family went to Nigeria. So yeah. You have brothers and sisters at this stage?
I've got a sister.
Right.
Younger sister. So we decamped from Glasgow and went to Nigeria, which was an experience.
I bet it was.
In the early 60s.
And how long are you in Nigeria for?
5 years, right. till the Biafran War came about. And then when the machine gun bullets were flying around and things like that, the decision was made to get out of Dodge. Nothing to do with me. I didn't start it.
So your early schooling then was in Nigeria. So what was
like? Yeah. I went a little bit to school in Glasgow.
Yeah.
And then went to Nigeria and went to school. You did half a day. It was good. I've got vague memories of it, like riding a horse through the school playground or something like that. Somebody brought a horse in one day, just the sort of thing like that. But it was okay. I have vague memories of it. It was a sort of, we lived a very sort of privileged lifestyle, company flat in, you know, nice area. You had people to look after you. It was a sort of country club lifestyle. So I'd swim a lot, go to the country club and swim. And
so very different to Glasgow then?
Yeah, very different to Glasgow.
And was it a happy time for the family, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. We got to come home every so often. My dad would get a few weeks off. So we'd come home on a banana boat, on a working ship, so via the Canaries or something like that. So I did quite a lot of travelling in that period between sort of 5 and 10, more travelling to come later in life. But did all sorts of travelling. So went to places that I wouldn't have gone to and did it on a cargo ship or flew somewhere. We had a night in Libya once, and it was just strange and things like that because a plane got diverted.
But you wouldn't know any different at that age? You just went?
No, not really. And it was just, that was my normal lifestyle.
So what prompted?
It's been a struggle to adjust to not having that jet set lifestyle.
So what prompted the move back? Was it your dad's work again that
to the UK? It was to some extent the Biafran War. Right. It wasn't really safe to be out there. So I think the company made a decision to mass exodus. And so he got the posting to go from Nigeria to Trinidad.
You went to Trinidad after? I thought you came back to the UK.
Well, I did.
Right, okay.
I was of an age where my mum and dad, probably my mum, decided that from schooling purposes, I was better. She didn't think the secondary schools were up to the standard she wanted in Trinidad. So they all stayed in Trinidad and I went to Edinburgh, which broke my heart. I think I cried for 3 days.
Oh, bless you. So what age were you then? So about 10?
10.
And you were on your own in Edinburgh?
Well, not on my own. I think the plan was, because the company would have paid for me to go to a posh school and a fee-paying school, but my auntie, my uncle, who lived in Edinburgh, said, oh, come on, you can come and live with us, with my four cousins. So I went to live with them and went to, you know, local primary school and then local secondary school in Edinburgh.
Wow.
It was great. But the privileged lifestyle continued because every school holidays, Dunlop flew me out. So as a 10-year-old, you know, I'd get the plane down on my Todd from Edinburgh to London. Yeah. Chauffeur-driven limo would turn up at Heathrow with the old peak cap and everything like that, take me to a hotel near the airport, put me into the hotel as a 10-year-old on expenses. God, I wish I had it now. Ham sandwiches and bottles of Coke on the room service, and then the chauffeur would come back in the morning and stick me on a BOAC plane to the West Indies.
So you didn't have an escort accompanying you for the trip. You were allowed to do it independently at that age.
Yeah. It's weird when you think about it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, flew into Trinidad to meet the family, hoping not to get stopped by customs because I had Scottish pies, flat sausage, black pudding, fruit pudding,
a list.
White pudding, you know, all smuggled from my mum and dad.
Yeah.
So, it was privileged and it made me very independent.
I was going to say, it must be. And how, I mean, So we're going back a few years, obviously, but how did you feel being separated from your parents and your sister?
I cried for 3 days. I knew my auntie, my uncle and my cousins and everything like that, but you just couldn't believe that your mum had abandoned you.
Yeah, it must have felt
and
like
so, that. So it shapes you, really. Made me a right selfish bugger. I thought, right, I'm in this myself to some extent.
So how long were they in Trinidad for then?
About 3 years.
Right. And then they came back to the UK?
Yeah. So we'd got the glamorous posting of Glasgow to Nigeria, glamorous posting Nigeria to the West Indies.
Oh, here we go.
And then the most glamorous posting of all, the West Indies to Grimsby.
Ah.
So,
okay.
Right, okay. That was a culture shock.
So Dunlop had a factory in Grimsby?
They made these floatable hoses.
Right.
Big industrial hoses that used in the oil industry and offshore and everything like that. I didn't really understand it.
So at that point you moved to Grimsby, obviously, to be with the family.
Yeah, Cleethorpe. So, you know, Cleethorpe's slightly posher than Grimsby. Yes. Let's get it right.
The seaside. So you left Edinburgh, came to Grimsby, lived with the family there. So changed schools, obviously, educated in this area.
Yeah. So I went from a sort of senior secondary in Edinburgh. I didn't go to really posh school or anything like that, called Boroughmuir, which I really enjoyed. I've always enjoyed my schooling. I loved school.
And were you a clever boy, would you say?
I was just chatty, lively. I wasn't an academic necessarily because I didn't really work hard. I just loved socially being at school.
Yeah, with others.
Being with my mates, playing football in the playground.
Good footballer?
No.
Okay.
But I appreciated the game.
Yeah.
You know, I'm probably the one Glaswegian that's not a good footballer. But I sort of understood it and I've always loved it. Because I used to go, because Glasgow from a, excuse me, meandering, but I'll meander if that's all right with you.
Yeah.
Glasgow divided city between Rangers and Celtic.
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
And divided on religious basis. My dad was a Catholic, my mum was a Protestant, so my uncles and my grandpa used to take me to Rangers, where I have seen, I'm old enough to have seen Sir Alex Ferguson play. I keep mentioning him. But,
yeah, you've mentioned him a few times now.
I know, it's 3 times now. So I used to go and see Rangers, but my dad, when he came home, used to take me to see Celtic and some of my other uncles on the other side. But it was quite... I only found out the other week that because my dad was a Catholic and my mum was a Protestant, my dad's mum stopped. She didn't go, and my dad's brothers didn't go to my mum and dad's wedding, which was weird.
Yeah.
Very Glaswegian.
But clearly it wasn't an issue for them.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all.
Yeah.
So... Yeah.
Okay, so you arrive in Grimsby. You're
Cleethorpes.
Sorry, Cleethorpes. Let's get it right. You're at Cleethorpes. But you've moved since that. So you moved since then, didn't you? You didn't stay in this area. That wasn't you here and staying here.
There was further travel. I went to school there. I went to the local boys' grammar school, and then my education. If I wasn't academic before, I wasn't after a year when it became a comprehensive school, and they introduced girls into the educational mix, and that just blew my mind, basically.
In a good way?
Well, concentration went completely. There was all these kids that had been in a boys' school and never really seen girls before in a social situation. And suddenly for them to be in the class and things like that was just like, whoa, what's going on here?
Yeah,
school improved. So there was a generation, as it changed, of young boys in Cleethorpes whose academic achievements went nowhere. Sounds like I'm blaming girls. I'm not. It's just a distraction.
So where was it after Grimsby? You moved around again?
I stayed there for all my sort of for the rest of my education. And then went to, like I said, I wasn't academic, but I love going to school. I never missed school or anything like that. And I was sort of quite bright without getting any qualifications. I think I had a couple of E's at A level. And, you know, it was a case of, what the hell am I going to do? So I figured I'd probably end up working in an office because I had no discernible skills. Mm. Nobody tells you that, you know, you can chat for Britain. You fancy
well, there wasn't, in those days, there wasn't the career advice or guidance that there is these days, was there? It was kind of you're going to go and work in an office.
And I wasn't driven in the way that some children were driven and knew what they wanted to do, be it, you know, I want to be a scientist, I want to be a doctor, a lawyer, a bus driver, a train driver.
What were you interested in at that age? Did you have, I mean, you said you played football a little bit, but did you have a passion or anything?
Just football, really. I like football. I like sort of socialising, like chatting to people.
Girls?
Yeah, sort of, but still a bit scared of them. And I thought, right, let's see where I can get in. I'll do business studies, probably, because I'll end up working in an office, so I need some sort of business skills.
So this is going to college, then?
Yeah, so that mighty educational institution, the Birmingham Poly, offered me a place. I thought, well, Birmingham sounds all right. They've got some good clubs, loads of bands. It was, you know, when punk was just about happening and things like that, loads of bands.
So you're into music already at this age?
Lots of football teams. I just got into music in terms of seeing it live. Yeah. I was listening to stuff. I mean, I bought my first record in Nigeria in, I think, 1964. I'd bought The Stones. I can remember buying it in a record store.
So you were young then?
Yeah, I was five.
Yeah, that's very young to be buying records.
Yeah. Well, I bought The Stones, and I've had a lifelong love of the Rolling Stones. I've still got the single now.
Yeah. Some people listening won't know what a single is, but let's carry on.
Yeah, true. Okay. It's vinyl. It's a 7-inch.
It's round.
Yeah, I'm hoping it's worth some money, but I don't know whether it is. But so I thought, right, Birmingham, lots of football teams, West Brom, Villa, Birmingham City, got bands, let's just go. And I went, and I had an absolutely brilliant time. It was a sandwich course, so I did a year back in Grimsby working for Tate's. But in the 3 years I was at college, I had one night in, and for the life of me, I can't remember why I stayed in.
Didn't feel very well.
Well, I don't know. I genuinely don't know. And it was just, I mean, Birmingham was no disrespect to Birmingham, was a bit of a toilet then. It was, you know, like a lot of the UK, there had not been a great deal of investment in cities and all that sort of stuff. But I had a brilliant time. Go and see punk bands and out with your pals every night, drinking and going to the football. Part of me thought I need a social education as well. And I would always recommend to youngsters now, go if you can, if you get the opportunity. For the social education, just meet different people, do different things. And, you know, I've still got my mates from college.
So you obviously graduated from college at that point.
Honours degree, Anita. I've got an honours degree.
Congratulations.
In business
You've just
studies.
Been all these accolades through your life, which we'll come back to later on. But well done on that.
I was
clearly very proud of it.
Well, not really. I don't think I did any work, but enough to get by. I was out on the pop the night before all my exams, really.
No.
But I've got a piece of paper somewhere, and I blow the dust off it occasionally.
So what did you do with your honours degree then?
Nothing. Well, no, because, like I say, I figured I'd end up working in an office. And I'm trying to think of the timescale. I ended up going back to Cleethorpes because that's where the family home was at a time. I think I spent... I'm trying to think on the time. I can't quite get this right. The timescale wise, I spent a year on the dole at some point, which was okay.
A lot of people.
Living at home. Yeah. So not paying any board and lodging. You got your dole. I became quite fit and honed because I was running every day with my mates and things like that, as well as going to the pub a lot and playing snooker and football and stuff like that. It was all right, but... You know, somewhere along the line, you've got to get your head out your backside and go and do something. So I got a job, temporary job with Cleethorpes Borough Council as a trainee auditor. Whoa, how sexy is that? And highlights of career, counting penny chews at Immingham Leisure Centre. You know, whoa, this is exciting. And then did I lose it? I can't remember the timescale. But I ended up, a mate from college said, why don't you come and live with me in Mossley in the hills outside Manchester? So I went across there and got a a placement on a community programme, which was one of those things the government was running to get people into to employment. Mm. And in fairness, it was fantastic for me. I started as a painter and decorator, the world's worst painter and decorator, but my mate got his house painted for free, basically. I got paid through the community programme. Yeah. And then I got a job with Tameside Borough Council and ended up running the payments section. So I was the most popular man in the council, not because me wit and charm or anything like that, but I shelled out. I was in charge of shelling out all the money for everything. The councillors loved me because, you know, I'd pay out all their expenses. They didn't love me when I had to testify in court against some of them for being robbing so-and-sos, but that's something else entirely.
So how did you end up in a broadcasting role then?
It's a very good question. By sheer fortune, it was we had our first child by that point.
So you missed a big chunk of your life out here. You've met someone.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So went to the same school. Told you, distracted by girls. So we didn't go out at school.
Is Mrs. Burns from Grimsby then?
Cleethorpes. Come on, distinction as much as possible. Slightly posher. I knew her from school, sort of. I don't think we ever talked at school. I just looked at the long blonde head down the back. And so we sort of met at the council.
And did she, really. She came to Manchester with you then?
No.
Okay.
No, it was sort of
long
complicated.
Distance.
Yeah.
All right.
And then realised I had to move back because we had a son.
Okay.
Known as Noisy. Never disclose his real name. Because he'd just be embarrassed. I think they're all embarrassed by it. So Noisy, smelly and expensive are the three sons. So Kip thought, need to get back for family reasons to this side of the country. And there was a sort of finance and personnel job advertised at the BBC based in Chapel Street. So I applied for it and amazingly got it. And that made life easier. And from there, sort of my life changed a bit in a very good way.
So you
1987, I think, I joined the BBC late 87.
So you're in the finance department at the BBC.
Yeah, I was the sort of local administrator that they welcomed me with open arms because the lady that run it before, you'd have to go down on bended knee to get a fresh pen. And she didn't believe in soft toilet paper. So I was in control of all that, as well as the personnel and the trying to make the pennies add up and all that sort of jazz.
So you were very popular then?
Well,
for the right reasons,
paper,
yeah.
Soft toilet paper.
That was the way to go.
Yeah, and the BBC was a different animal there. So, you know, I had so I could buy wine and spirits and beer and stuff like that, because it was the culture, you know, the select few would get invited into the manager's office after work for a drink or something like that. It was a different culture. You can see why it probably changed. I don't know whether that sort of thing goes on anymore.
I can't imagine it does, but who knows, eh?
Yeah. Well, I used to love post-office drinks and things like that. In various places I've worked, it was, you know, it was always great. Like when I worked in Ashton-under-Lyne at Tameside Borough Council, where I was head of the payments. I used to love the 5 o'clock Friday session with everybody. Brilliant.
Yeah.
You may gather through this, I quite like a drink.
You've mentioned that a few times as well as Alex, Sir Alex Ferguson. So you're working at the BBC, obviously enjoying that role. How did you end up behind the microphone then?
Right. I did that for 7 years, doing the finance and personnel, doing all sorts, and running listener trips. Where it took hundreds of people abroad on the ferries to...
Who'd won a competition or something?
No, they paid for it.
Through the BBC?
Yeah, I know. That's
well, they're a travel company as well in those days.
That's why they got the trips got axed. But they were. I used to run them. I was the apprentice at one point to running them, and then I took them over. So if there's anybody out there, because I'm looking for a job, fancy somebody who can organise taking anywhere between 250 and 700 people abroad for a weekend, I can do it.
So that was a little unexpected, chaperoning people across Europe via Nosy Ferries. But again, so going back to the broadcasting, how did you move from the office job to the studio?
It was a gradual process. It took a while. I started doing, through people that worked at the station, I knew something about football. And by this time I'd thought, hold on, I could do this. I'm in the BBC.
Commentary,
now.
You mean?
Well, yeah, something, broadcasting. This is an opportunity. Suddenly I'm in a place where I feel, actually, I might have, there's a possibility I could find out whether I've got any talent at this. This is way more exciting than counting penny chews and, you know, doing paperwork and what have you. So I started to get in and I started to do Club Call, which was a phone line for football fans right across the country, because local radio stations weren't necessarily doing commentary or anything like that then, only on special occasions. But Club Call, you paid some extortionate rate per minute to listen to the commentary. You dial the phone and at the other end of the phone would be me at Boothbury Park or at Grimsby Town doing a commentary. Just
people,
on the Todd.
People listen to it on the phone, yeah, the commentary. People,
yeah. But it was a great grounding. So for 90 minutes, I'm on my Todd, no summariser or anything like that, describing the action. And then you'd do an interview with a manager and a player after the game and, again, send it down the line. And that was a fantastic grounding.
And commentating on anything, especially live sport, is really hard.
It depends. I found I could do it. Weirdly enough,
it's obviously a natural.
I mean, there is
skill.
A tape. There is a tape that exists of an early one I did as a try for the radio station, and by all accounts, it's shocking. But it was just once you got used to it, with my natural wit and charm, I just sort of injected that into it, and I sort of knew football, and my eyesight was all right then, so I sort of knew the players and what have you. And Club Call was a great grounding. And then the opportunity came, I think, Lord Tonder of Blundell Park, John Tonder, our Grimsby Town commentator, failed a fitness test on a Saturday morning. And Dave Gibbons, the sports editor of the radio station, rang me up and said, any chance you can get to Blackpool to do the Grimsby game this afternoon? And I went and did some reports. And then out of that, I got more on the radio. But I was still doing the day job.
Yeah.
And this was the sort of weekend job. And the BBC is a wonderful organisation, and it sent me on a sort of news conversion course for 7 weeks. So I went to, you know, learn properly how to be a reporter and all about the law, so I didn't drop the BBC in it. Yeah, few occasions where I dropped the BBC in it, but and then it came. So after 7 years, I made the conversion from doing what I was doing in finance and personnel to become a fully-fledged sports reporter.
And it was just a sports beat that you were doing? You weren't in general?
It was just sport.
Yeah.
And loved it. I suddenly, because I wasn't a boy or a man, or I'm not even a man now, if I'm being honest, that's got a plan, that's ever had a plan. So I fell into it, but suddenly I felt at home and I thought, this is it. This is, you know, here's me, the football fan from Glasgow, doing football.
Your dream
Somebody's
job.
Paying me to talk about football
and watching the games,
talk to players and managers and everything like that. It was just wow. Who knew? If only somebody had said that years before. I felt I probably wasted many years not knowing.
So, how
what
old
I
would you have been
do.
At this stage?
Oh,
do you think?
I was afraid you were going to ask that question. I'm not sure.
20s, 30s?
How
many children
20s?
Do you think you had at that point?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. One was
You're
born,
still quite young, though, when you were doing this?
Ish, but I do feel that if I'd known earlier, I probably could have got into it earlier. But then again, I'd have missed out on listener trips.
Which you clearly loved.
Yeah, I loved them.
So sport was your focus, but obviously we know you as...
Yeah.
More of a general broadcaster. So, when did you transition more into?
Well, just to sort of go through the process, the story. So, I did sports reporter, and then I got a chance to go to Radio Sheffield. BBC Radio Sheffield sort of headhunted me in the days when you were allowed to do that sort of thing rather than formally going through interviews or anything like that. Barnsley had gone up to the Premier League, and Simon Clark, who worked at Radio Sheffield, was moving on to Radio Leeds, and he recommended me to go and be joint sports editor and also do Barnsley in the Premier League. So I did that and went to Sheffield for 4 years, which was just magic. I learned a lot there.
You moved over there, obviously, as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And lived in Hillsborough. Well, I lived in two or three different places. But it was great. I loved it. Absolutely loved it. It was a fantastic sports patch. And I was doing Barnsley and Sheffield United and Sheffield Wednesday and Donny and Chesterfield. And it really grew me as a broadcaster because it was a big sort of city station. And I got to present the world's oldest football phone-in. I don't know whether you know this, but it was invented at BBC Radio Sheffield. It's called Praiser Grumble, which I nicked it when I came back here.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, but the world's oldest phone-in, football phone-in, is called Praiser Grumble. And so for 4 years, I was, you know, presenting on and off, not every week because we shared it out, Praiser Grumble. And it taught me so much. It was just fantastic. So I did 4 years there, and then I got to the point, well, how do I move on? To some extent, I'd become interested in a career. And I got offered, I applied, the BBC were going to start a new station alongside BBC Five Live. They were going to start an all-day sports station. So I applied for that, and they said, yeah, we want to offer you a contract for a year, either doing the breakfast show, probably doing the breakfast show. But it never quite happened, and I wasn't sure whether I could hack London Life.
Oh, that would have been in London then.
Yeah.
Right.
So during the 2000 Olympics, I said, look, can we do a trial? You know, I'm not sure I'm good enough. Can I come down? So I went and read all the sports bulletins on Radio 1 with Chris Moyles, Radio 2 with Steve Wright, Simon Mayo, Johnny Walker.
God, I don't remember. I would have been listening around then. I don't remember you.
Yeah, I probably didn't make an impression. Radio 4 once, I think, or twice. That was just a strange experience. Very overstaffed Radio 4. People telling you halfway through a bulletin, we want you out at such and such and such and such a time. Within 30 seconds, they'd change their mind. Two producers in the studio with you and wanted you out at a different time. It was just complete. Can I say bollocks?
But I can.
Right, it was just bollocks, basically. But anyway, and Radio 5 I did. So I had 2 months down there. But, you know, at the end of the 2 months, both my liver and my credit card were waving the white flag because on my Todd, and I would, strangely enough, like college, I was out every night.
And the family was still in Sheffield?
The family were in Hull at that point.
Oh, right, okay.
They were in Hesel. Oops, sorry, bang the microphone there. Yeah, the family were in Hesel.
Right.
So I was just
so you moved out, back north?
Out every night. Well, I sort of went back to Sheffield, and the then editor of Radio Humberside, or maybe she was the big boss of the TV and radio operation, said, look, our sports output's in a mess. Do you want to come back? And made me big promises to come back. Not all of which I got, but there was
enough
a lesson.
Enough for you to...
Well, yeah, I thought, right, to come back and run the station and the family were here and everything like that. And it was good. I don't regret it. Had a great time. So that came back as sports editor, brilliant time being sports editor, because I came back and was given carte blanche to do what I wanted. So I made sure we did commentary on every game. I brought in expert summarisers to sit alongside the commentators. Mm-hmm. I extended the hours, brought the football phone in with me, inspired by Praiser Grumble, but it was called the Football Forum. And I don't know whether I can tell this story, but the very first call, because I'd persuaded the boss to do it after a game, was, and you might have to look this up, I think it might exist on the internet. Very first call, Burnsy, I've been to City today, it was brilliant, they've won 4-1, it's fantastic. I'm so excited. Oh, yeah. I'm off for home for four Yorkshire puddings and a, and then there was an act of self-pleasure mentioned.
Okay, oh, dear. Right,
put it that way. And I just thought, oh, God, first call, the boss will cancel it. We'll never have a football phone in again. But in fairness to her, she stuck with it. And I was just dumbfounded because I would have normally been sharp and said, well, most people just have gravy with them. But...
It would have been funny.
Yeah. But I was like, oh, blimey. But from then it sort of took off and we won awards that, you know, I considered as the best, with the rest of the team, the best local radio sports team in the country. I mean, when I showed you a Sony Award, we won one for our sports coverage. You know, we beat Talk Sport, we beat Five Live. We lost out to the, well, the one that won it was Fighting Talk on Radio 5 Live, which is not a sports programme, still winds me up.
Do you listen to it now?
But it's not a proper sports programme. We were a proper sports programme. That's just light entertainment. And we, and the World Service Sport came in second. So I rightfully claimed we were the best sports team in the country. We beat them all. And so we made it into an essential listen, I think, for sports fans, which we're really proud of.
And at what point did you start commentating on the going doing the Hull City games then? Was this about this time or is that?
Well, I was sort of, I mean, I'd been doing some Hull City before I went to Sheffield, but this was, as sports editor, I was flitting around Scunthorpe, Grimsby,
all the games.
And City, because I needed to get to all the clubs to see what was going on and show my face and, you know, do it. We had dedicated commentators for each of the teams and I'd just rock up and try and steal some glory from them.
No, so football is clearly a passion of yours.
Yep.
So why did you move from the sports editor role then to the more mainstream broadcasting?
Less hours and more money.
Good answer.
That's we'd introduced a programme called Sports Talk on every night from 6 o'clock. And me, Matt Dean, Mike White and Gwillam and the journalists, sports journalists from the local papers at the Hull Daily Mail, Grimsby and Scunthorpe Telegraphs had made it a great success. It had become an essential listen. It was, you know, a very funny programme, but very informative. And the big boss at the time said, look, can you work your magic if I move you to mid-mornings? See if you can get the audience up. And do you fancy it? I said, well, only if I can continue to do the football.
Right, okay.
So I'll do that, pay me extra for the football on top.
Mm.
And it was fantastic. I loved doing it. But it genuinely was less hours because I was working about 70 hours a week as sports editor to make it the best in the country because I was driven by that time. I'd suddenly discovered drive in my life when I came into the BBC. I hadn't had it before. And so it was less hours. Still got to do the football. And more money. Happy days.
And did you have a plan for the mid-morning show? When you got that... You had this slot, daily slot, that was going to be yours. Did you think, right, this is what I'm going to do with it? Or did you, because you've mentioned a few times you didn't have a plan. You just kind of winged it.
Yes.
Was it the same with this
slot? There was a little element of both, but I sort of knew what I wanted to do.
What was that?
I just wanted to make a difference. I didn't want it to be po-faced or anything like that. I wanted to get into everything. Be it politics, be it sport, be it music, be it culture, be it humour, whatever, music, comedians. I just wanted it to be all in business. I wanted it to be all encompassing and reflect what was going on in the area. But I also wanted it to rattle people's cages in power. And I wanted to give people a voice.
And... Yeah, so that I was going to get to that because the big part of your show was the listener involvement.
Yeah.
It was getting people to ring up and say what was on their mind or what was peeving them or indeed what they wanted to celebrate. So did you set out to have it to be a two-way street, if you like, your show involving all the listeners?
Yes.
Yeah, right, okay.
Definitely. Because, you know, I was there. I was a public servant. And I think people sometimes forget that. I was a public servant. I was there to serve the public. And try and justify my salary and the licence fee by giving the public
a
chance
voice.
To be part of it.
Yeah,
give them a voice.
Yeah.
So if, you know, they rang up and said, look, I'm having problems with the council or whatever, I can't make them to do this, I need this doing if possible. It's blighting my life. Can you help, Ernsie? And we soon established a reputation for doing it, knocking on the doors of organisations, saying, Ellie, what are you doing here? Can you sort it out? And because it was the BBC, you got a bit more clout, so you managed to get it done. And that creates a snowball effect. So one person thinks, well, he sorted them out. Maybe he'll help me. And, you know, it takes it on. But all done in such a way, it was all sort of crammed in the 3 hours.
3 hours, yeah.
We did all sorts, really. And, I genuinely wanted it to be the best radio show in the country, which it became.
Let's just quickly talk about your awards then, because...
No, it's all right. I never mentioned them. It's a regular listener to the show. I never mentioned them.
Was it three in succession or something like that?
Yeah, 302 awards.
Media awards,
Yorkshire and Humber Broadcaster of the Year.
Yeah.
Which is good. I was chuffed about.
For three.
And various radio academies. The radio station won Station of the Year at the radio academies. I was a big part of that. Obviously, it was a team effort. I mean, on my show, the producers were brilliant, kept me on the straight and narrow. Mm-hmm. They did all the work, making the calls and all that sort of stuff.
Lining up the guests, yeah.
Yeah.
Hugely successful show, and obviously the awards, the accolades you won during that time, very well deserved. And I know people joke about it, but yeah, it was a huge achievement, and we shouldn't in any way dampen that achievement. But I want to talk a bit about the show. You'll have so many stories and memories. Mm-hmm. You wanted to make a positive difference. So what do you remember? What was the main difference you make? Is there an example of where you're proudest, if you like, achievement as far as the show's concerned?
There's a few that I would probably mention. I'll go back to the listener involvement sort of thing. I felt this was an area that hid its light under a bushel, and certainly a city in Hull that hid its light under a bushel. So I wanted to celebrate local success and big us up, really. So I was a big voice pre-City of Culture saying, look, we need to go for this and everything like that. And we go back to the listener involvement. One of the things I'm proud of was a guy in Gull called Tony sent me an email, said, have you been down Holderness Road to, I think it's 371 Holderness Road? I said, no, go and have a look. So I went down and there's this derelict house with a blue plaque on it, and the roof's open, and, you know, it's basically turned into a crack den or something like that, and only pigeons and junkies are living in it and using it. And I go and look at the blue plaque, and J. Arthur Rank was born here in what have you, famed for his contribution to Cockney rhyming slang, but also... which goes back to the story previously.
Let's move on.
Join the dots, move on. So I thought, wow, Hull lad, who went on to become arguably, at one point in his career, one of the biggest figures in world entertainment. Mm. They had an empire.
We're talking about cinemas for those, the younger ones.
Well, yeah, bingo halls. Yep. You know, the Bond films came from Rank Studios and everything like that. Joan Collins was signed as a Rank starlet. All that sort of thing. Martin Scorsese was inspired by a Rank film to become a director. At one point, my people were talking to Martin Scorsese.
Oh, listen to you, my people.
my people were talking to his people about trying to get him to Hull to open it, because, you know, we managed to save the Rank House and get it redone and renovated, and people live in it now. People who wouldn't have had an opportunity to have anywhere to live. So that was one. Dead Bod.
Yeah, I remember that one.
Yeah. You know, all that sort of thing. The bridge across the A63. I was the one banging on about it endlessly on the radio, saying it's not safe across the A63. We're going to develop the Humber Street area. We need to get a bridge over there. And so I banged on about that. And, you know, other people worked really hard. Emma Hardy made a big contribution to it. But all that sort of stuff. But that the Rank House, because it came from a listener. And Dead Bod came from a listener saying, anything you can do. Are you aware of Dead Bod? I wasn't aware of Dead Bod.
Most people weren't. I mean,
no, exactly.
You brought it to the fore, didn't you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Here's this urban, well, maritime graffiti on a bit of corrugated iron. And it's, you know, one of the proudest moments of my life that it's now hanging in the Humber Street Gallery. It's a piece of art. It's a piece of culture. And you see the T-shirts. I was walking through New York once wearing a Dead Bod T-shirt, New York, and somebody shouts, "Hey up, Benzie, how are you?" And recognised the Dead Bod T-shirt. Yeah.
So you did make a difference.
Yeah. I'm proud of that.
And
I think it was important. I go back to I was a public servant. There was no point just turning up and here's Shawadi Wadi. Was there really?
Because there actually wasn't that much music on your show, really.
Yeah, that was a bone of contention with the bosses.
Well, the fact there wasn't that much.
Well, they wanted, not initially, you know, post actually winning the award, it was, well, you need to play more music.
But people weren't tuning in to listen to music.
No, nobody listens to local radio for the music, unless it's a specialist music show. They want the chat. They want that magic moment where somebody rings in with an utterly daft call. You know, Bernsie, it's Rose in Pocklington. Hi, Rose, what's up? I've got a frog in my toilet. And have you, Rose? Yeah. I've got a frog in my toilet. What's the problem? Well, when I'm using my toilet, my frog's looking up at me. And I said, well, imagine the trauma the poor frog's going through. You know, just moments like that, really. Yeah. It's just,
what was your most embarrassing, if you want to share, I'm sure you will, most embarrassing moment, maybe, that you can remember?
No, I blanked those out. I'm sure there must have been some.
Something funny you could share?
Well, something, I did North Ferriby and I can't remember whether it was an FA Vase or FA Trophy final when they won at Wembley. And my dear pal, the G Meister General, Gwilym Lloyd, he on the day couldn't remember whether it was an FA Vase or an FA Trophy final. Okay. And he got the wrong one. He's doing the celebration and the lifting of the trophy. And he got the wrong one. So I'm presenting the show and I knew there'd be something out on the pitch. So I sort of redid it live to get the right trophy. And I got the right trophy in, but rather than the champagne corks are popping, it came out as the champagne cocks.
Here we are again on that subject.
here we are again. And then myself and Matt Dean, just live on air, were falling about laughing for about 2 minutes. I'm trying to apologise and that was just, you know. So there were embarrassing moments.
Yeah, but I think one of the joys of your show was the authenticity and it just felt very real.
Yeah.
And because it was live, it was kind of warts and all and almost part of that anticipation of what's the next caller going to say. Because you didn't know what was coming.
No.
And, you know, it could have been.
Yeah.
But it made it entertaining.
Yes. But the other thing I was trying to do, I was trying to make it a mix. So I'd have a business leader on, council leader. Business was important to me. I mean, it can be a bit dry, but you can have good conversations about business because these are the people, you know, bringing jobs in, making investment and everything like that. And it doesn't have to be dry or humourless or anything like that. It just has to be entertaining.
Because business people are people at the end of the day.
Exactly.
They have personalities.
Who've got something about them.
You'd like to think.
They were doing something and they were making a difference.
Yeah.
So I try to reflect that as well and sticking bands and comedians on and everything that was going on, really.
So we were all disappointed when it came to an end. Mm. No one more so than yourself. So what have you been doing since? And what does life look like now?
It looks fairly rubbish, really. It's hit me quite hard. I mean, it was coming down the line.
Yeah.
I knew it was coming down the line.
The BBC was making a lot of changes.
We want 6 records an hour now. And I'm thinking, oh, sod off. I'd rather have a caller on or a guest on, you know, and we want you to do that. And it was becoming light and fluffy and it was becoming BBC Radio McDonald's right across the country. Every radio station the same and the same sound.
Because content was being created. It wasn't being created locally.
It was still being created locally, but they wanted this identikit sound and everything. And that's not me. I've always wanted to, from a broadcasting point of view, stand out from the crowd, be different, you know. And I felt we were going away from what we should be as a show in a radio station. So I don't know how long I would have lasted, and I'd been thinking, yeah, maybe the time has come to hang up the mic, at least on the daytime show, maybe. But keep the football. But no, neither has happened. And I've found it really difficult.
Because am I right in thinking it was about 30 years in total at the BBC?
1987. You do the maths, I'm rubbish at
stuff. It's a long
like
time.
That. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a lot, yeah.
So a massive change for you then?
Yeah, because, I've gone from a, hate to mention it, multi-award winning broadcaster to a multi-award winning alcoholic now.
Now, you are doing, you have got another show.
I know, but it's not the same profile. And it's great. I've got a show on Hull's 107 FM, which is a community station, which, God bless them, have offered me anything I want, really. But I've always fancied being John Peel. John Peel was one of my heroes. He helped shape my musical
taste.
Sound
a bit like him sometimes.
Well, yeah. And so I'm just a couple of hours on a Monday night playing some obscure tunes.
Do you get to choose the music?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that's the appeal there then.
Yeah, and just, have a bit of a chat and play some music and try and, relax doing it, and hopefully people like it. And it's picking up an audience. We're getting... People are certainly online. They used to get, no disrespect to anybody else on the station, maybe a few hundred might listen online. Now there's thousands sort of across the world. I think first couple of shows, they were listening in Afghanistan, Russia, Iran. I only needed North Korea, and then I'd got the Axis of Evil FM. But weirdly enough, I mentioned that on air. They're listening in Afghanistan, Russia, and Iran. Next week, we spotted that they were listening in Cheltenham, which is the home of GCHQ.
There you go.
It's weird. So I've not had any contact from the government. I'm not a sleeper agent. But I enjoy it. I'm just playing some tunes I like, and hopefully people like them, and getting some nice feedback. And I'm doing a city podcast, a whole city podcast, with the whole Daily Mail.
Well, I was going to ask you about the football, because clearly you're still very passionate about it. Why wouldn't you be? So is that your connection still with Hull City at the moment?
Yeah, so the Hull Daily Mail were good enough to invite me onto the new podcast, The 1904 Club, which goes out generally on a Monday on all good podcast platforms.
And is that a weekly show?
Yes, and we're also putting it out on 107 FM on a Tuesday night. And that's the connection, because I'm still hugely interested in football. I had hoped to be... To come back to BBC Radio on my side to do the football, but the gentleman's agreement that was in place didn't quite come to pass. But such is life. So I'm enjoying doing that, so it's keeping me involved. And it was good of them to ask me, and hopefully people enjoy it.
Yeah, I'm sure they do, because you are a fantastic broadcaster, and that's why people are so disappointed when your show came to an end. I'm conscious of the time, so just a couple of things I wanted to ask you. So, any regrets? Anything you would have done differently looking back now over your career?
I wish I'd been a bit more driven early on. I wish I'd realised the possibilities. And, maybe I should have gone to daytime radio a little earlier. Maybe I should have, I don't know, maybe I should have pushed harder when I was down at the networks, but I missed going to Rochdale on a Saturday afternoon rather than reading a sports bulletin on Radio 1. I was quite... Maybe I needed... I wound people up. So I got banned a few times at various clubs, and people didn't talk to me for a while.
Do you regret that, though? Because isn't that what people like about
maybe
you?
I could have taken a slightly different approach, but I was... I don't know... Because I tended to want to tell the story. I wasn't interested in all the happy, clappy PR guff that was around. I just wanted to get to the story. So trod on a few toes. But by and large, those that I wound up along the way were sort of kissed and made up. By and large, I think.
Oh, there's another story there.
I'm trying to think. I was banned for a time at various various football clubs.
Yeah.
But only because I was telling the truth and doing my job, really.
Yeah.
But I just wonder whether I could have done it in a different way. It's not really a regret. Made me who I was as a broadcaster. I think it gave me a bit of credibility.
It did. And I think, it, you know, that's what you were known for. So, yeah. You know, that was your reputation, but in a positive way. And, you know, you've got the successful career behind you to back that up.
It's definitely behind me. That's the worrying thing. I feel I've still got more to offer, but it's just...
Do you? Yeah. I mean,
No disrespect,
but you know, you and I both, we're not spring chickens.
No.
So we've got to, you know, we're the wrong side of 50, let's put it that way.
Yeah, so, and the rest for me.
So, you know, what would you like to do?
I'd like to broadcast.
Right, okay.
I'm good at it. I still feel I've got something to offer for a while before the head goes. I mean, the big worry, I've you know, getting serious... Three parents and in-laws have had dementia. And, you know, that's a worry as to, you get to this stage in life, you think, is my head going to go? You know, I don't want to be a shuffling wreck or anything like that. So I feel I've still got something to offer, whether it's, I don't know whether it'd be 5 days a week or anything like that. But you'd like to think you're still relevant. Otherwise, what the hell do you do?
Yeah. You need an outlet as well for you.
You know, how many places in the sun can you watch, you know, and dream? And, you know, you need...
You need a purpose.
Yeah, I still want to make a difference, you know, I think.
Well, that actually brings me very... It's a good segue to the question that was left by our previous guest.
Oh, blimey. This is the bit I've been dreading.
You don't have to, honestly, because it's such a good question. So this was the question actually left by our guest prior to the last podcast, because the last podcast was actually me being interviewed by my daughter. So,
I saw that.
Yeah. So the guest before that left
a
question.
It's called nepotism, that.
There was a question left by our previous, that guest, and she didn't know that you were going to be this guest.
Right.
So, but the question is, what would you like your legacy to be?
Oh, I don't know.
Which, on the back of the last conversation, sounds like it's a bit...
Yeah, to some extent, final, I suppose I've left my legacy, really. Suddenly, that question's made me feel quite emotional.
I know, well, do you know what? When I was thinking I'm going to ask you this question, you've just been saying what you were saying about dementia and stuff, and you still want to broadcast everything. I think, oh my God, the question I'm just going to ask.
Yeah, it feels quite final. Yeah. To some extent, I think my legacy's there, really.
Mm.
From a footballing point of view, over the last however many years, I was there at all the big moments to describe it. You know, I was there when Luke Campbell came back to the City. I had the great privilege of being on the City Hall balcony to introduce him to the crowd and everything like that. You know, I can always say I introduced the Ming City Rockers on a stage at the back of Humber Street for, I can't remember, but the Sesh or the Freedom Festival. You know, so my legacy is quite a lot, really.
But don't you think that's an amazing thing to be able to say, because you've had so much influence and been involved in so many things and made such a difference in this area, that the fact you can't actually name one thing is a fantastic position to be in.
It is. But it's you know... It feels like, well, that's the end of it. Yeah,
no.
You're not going to do anything useful again. But, you know, I'm pleased with what I did.
Yeah. So there are no regrets?
No, not really. I could have been better. You can always be better. Yeah. That was a tough question.
Sorry, don't blame me.
No. I'll let the legacy stand for itself, really.
Yeah. Yeah, and let's, I'm sure there's many more things you are going to achieve and much more difference, is that good grammar, that you're going to make in the future.
Well,
going forward.
You just got to keep breathing and keep going, haven't you? I told you at the top of this, essentially I'm a miserabilist, and
Are you a glass half empty person, do you think?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely, which is... It's interesting because the more I'm not a happy clapper, the more optimistic you are, the longer you live. I don't know whether I can say this, it's a miserable way to end, but you get to my stage in life and you think, right, when am I going to die?
Oh.
No, seriously, that's the question that if you could answer, you could maybe plan a bit better. And bear in mind, I've told you already, don't really plan. But, you know, your finances and all that sort of thing, and what you're going to do with your life. When are you going to die? There's such a thing called the Google death clock. You ever heard of this?
No, I have not.
Okay.
Do I want to know about this? Go on then, tell us.
Okay, I'll tell you. You can edit it out. We might not want to talk about it. But you can go on Google, answer a few questions, and it'll tell you, it'll predict when you're going to die.
Oh, my God.
Okay. So,
and you've done this, I can tell.
I've done this. So in many ways, it's a bonus we've got through this podcast because it says I'm going to die when I'm 64. I'm 64.
Oh, Bernsey.
Okay. But going back to the glass half empty thing,
yeah.
If you change it and are a bit more optimistic in some of your answers.
It adds years.
So I think I've got about an extra 30 minutes.
So your New Year's resolution is...
I don't do them. Can't keep them. But anyway. Sorry, that is a miserable way to end on. And there was you, all full of joy and hope for 2024. Yeah, tell me what my New Year's resolution is, Anita.
I am the absolute opposite of you. Yeah. I am such a glass half full, and I try and... anyway. Your New Year's resolution should be to live in the present and appreciate everything, take every day as a gift, knowing you're going to die, because clearly you think you are, and just live in the moment and stop worrying.
I always have done that through my life, but, you know, you get to a certain stage where you think, right, how long have I got?
But you're a grandparent now, aren't you?
Yeah, weep out and little urn.
Yeah, so what...
Annoying little buggers.
Have you given them nicknames as well?
Weep out and little urn. That is actually, it's Patrick and Ernest.
Oh, right,
okay. Just called Weep out and little urn. So, and they're great, but they are a royal pain in the rump.
Yeah. Well, youngsters, how old are they?
Weepat's 8, January, and Urn's 5.
Oh, gorgeous age. Yeah. I bet you had a great Christmas.
It was all right. They're just they're very bright,
yeah.
But they are...
They're little boys.
Yes, they are little boys.
Little
boys. Yeah, and... Yeah, I can take them in relatively small...
That's a great
doses.
Thing about being a grandparent. You can hand them back. Yeah, yeah. Well, seriously, no. Thank you. I really appreciate you coming in today.
Sure, I've enjoyed it. It feels like a confessional.
I've enjoyed our chat.
I know, I'm really sorry. I'm happy, really. I'm happy. Be happy in 2024.
Trust me. We will be.
Live life to the full.
And I'm sure we will be talking again a lot for many years to come.
Well, hopefully.
No, seriously, thank you. Really appreciate it. And thank you for listening, watching, joining us for this Pacecast. If you've got any questions, suggestions as to who we could interview going forward, please do get in touch via our usual channels. And I look forward to talking to you again next month. Until then, bye-bye.
This Pacecast was recorded and produced by Engine 7 Audio, award-winning audio production.